Well, coming into today, I thought that the most controversial thing I was going to say was talking bad about the steps of salvation. But I've received a lot of comments about tonight's lesson, about the coat of many colors. I appreciate everyone's support this morning. Everybody was very kind. I appreciate that very much. Eddie Ray, I love what you said. He came up to me and he said, that was a great lesson, but don't you mess with Ford. And he was messing with me. But by the way, that car was not made by Ford. It's made in Korea. They slapped the Ford name on it. And just to show you that I have nothing against Ford, if anybody would like to get me a Ford Bronco for Christmas, I would gladly accept it. Anyway. All right, so tonight we are going to continue with our Unsolved Mysteries lessons. And this one was not part of the original schedule. A few weeks ago, I had said, hey, I'm finished with the ones I had planned on doing. Do you guys want me to do a few more? Because one of the things that as I've been going through my Bible reading this year, I've been flagging some things and some things that I, you know, was already aware of but had never really taught about before. And one of them was this. Years ago, and I don't remember how long ago it was, that I found out about this kind of question. I did a class at Bellevue on the life of Joseph. And as I was doing a deep dive, I found out that apparently there's some controversy as to what Joseph's coat was like. And I was not aware of that before. So that's where that came from. And you may be, you know, I know you're, some of you are thinking this way because you told me, but you may have had running through your mind, like, what do you mean a mystery? Of course Joseph's coat had many colors. I mean, you know, like every Sunday school lesson I've ever had, you know, had Joseph like this, right? I mean, this is what his coat looked like, right? Or if you were, you know, the flannel graph lessons, you know, and Joseph always looked like this, right? I mean, Joseph, that's the way we think of when we think of Joseph. It's ingrained in our minds, right? And even beyond church and Sunday school, even in popular culture, you know, very famous Broadway musical, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, which I think was the first Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. I may be wrong about that, but back in the late 60s, early 70s, that there has been, is, you know, big time Broadway production focused clearly on Joseph and his incredible coat. And if you prefer your flavor of Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat to be Donny Osmond, Donny Osmond did a direct-to-video movie, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, in the late 90s, and clearly his coat had lots and lots of colors. So that's what we think of when we think of Joseph, as we think about his coat of many colors. And so you may be going, well, you know, there's no controversy. My Bible says many colors. What are you talking about? Well, at the top of the first page of the handout, I've just kind of given you a taste of the root of the problem. Now, it's not a problem. We'll talk about later why it's not a problem. But, you know, if you grew up with the King James Bible or even the American Standard Version, which most of us did. I mean, I grew up with King James. I mean, I don't know if I'm still at a point where most of the scripture that I've memorized is King James or not. My youth was King James was my primary Bible, as everybody's was. And then from kind of my early adult years in the first 10 or 15 years, I was New American Standard. Now, New American Standard also says many colors. But I learned a lot of scripture in New American Standard. And then for the last, 15 years, I have been English Standard Version is my primary version. But I grew up on the King James. I cut my teeth on the King James. And King James says many colors. As a matter of fact, all three of those that I just mentioned, New American Standard, English Standard Version, all say many colors. But that is not universally true. And just at the top, I've just given you a flavor. This is all in Genesis 37. The Hebrew behind what's translated many colors appears five times in Scripture. Three of those related to Joseph, and all three of those in chapter 37, which you would imagine, because after 37, we don't talk about the coat anymore. Okay. But in 37, it appears three times. And the King James says many colors. And I, even my translation, the ESV, says many colors. By the way, the King James spells colors with the British spelling, C-O-L-O-U-R-S. English Standard, C-O-L-O-R-S. But then the next one I've got there listed is the NIV. And I've designated that the NIV 84 for a reason. I'll talk about that more in a minute. But the NIV translates that as richly ornamented. His robe being richly ornamented. And then the New Revised Standard Version, which is also what the Revised Standard Version says, is a long robe with sleeves. And this just gives us a taste of the fact that there's not agreement about what the words that are translated many colors really mean. And that's the root of it. So the next part where it says, why is this unsolved? It's that. And you guys know this, I say this all the time. I am not a Hebrew scholar, I'm not an original language scholar, but I can read about what the scholars think, just like anybody else can. And this is, as I understand it, this is what the controversy or the disagreement over what these words mean comes to, okay? There's two words, and I've got them in bold there in the section called Why Is This Unsolved? It's Kethonet Passim. Now that's written in English. Those are not the Hebrew. That is the transliterated Hebrew into English. The Hebrew is written out beside of it, if you guys can read Hebrew. But this is what I understand is the source of the disagreement among scholars as to what those two words mean. Okay? One of those words, the first one, the kethonet, is the word that is talking about tunic, robe. Okay. The second word is the word that is in the KJV translated as colors, okay, many colors. If you look up both of those words in a Hebrew dictionary, okay, and I did that, okay, and in my Hebrew dictionary, I have several, but one of the ones that I use, the first thing it says about kethoneth is this: from an unused word. Wait a minute, what do you mean unused? It's right there in the text. How can it be unused? And then the next one, when I look up passim, in this dictionary, you can't find the word passim, but you can find the root word, which is pas, P-A-S. It says also from an unused word. And my understanding is that these are two Hebrew words that are rarely found in even ancient literature. And so, because they are not part of current Hebrew, and they were not even part of what we know of as ancient Hebrew, there is massive disagreement over what they meant. Now, the Genesis, the beginning of the translation many colors, is the Septuagint. Now, you've probably heard the name Septuagint before, even if you don't know exactly what that means. But the Septuagint was the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Okay. By the time you get to the Septuagint was translated in over a period of time from the 200s, probably from the 300s to the 200s BC. So we're talking about the intertestamental period, the time between the time recorded in the Old Testament and the time recorded in the New Testament. That is when the Septuagint translation was begun and completed. By that time, largely the world did not speak Hebrew. And so there was a push to have a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. Greek was becoming the predominant language of the world. And so there was a push to have a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and that came out to be the Septuagint. Almost always, when you read an Old Testament quotation in the New Testament, quotation from where Paul quotes the Old Testament, it is obvious that Paul was using the Septuagint, or Peter, or Jesus. Okay, that was the Bible of the New Testament, if you will. Those that were responsible for writing the New Testament were using the Septuagint, because they all spoke Greek. And so they were using the Septuagint translation. So in the terms of history of the church, the Septuagint is a very, very important translation. But we now know that there are things in the Septuagint that were not translated correctly. And if you think about it, If the Septuagint was translated into 300 to 200 BC, that's still probably at least 1,500 years after the time of Joseph. And as I understand it, by that time, no one knew what those Hebrew words meant, really. Okay, other than this is describing an article of clothing, we don't know what it's describing. And so the translators chose many colors. That's what they chose in the Septuagint. Again, I'm dumbing it down for myself, okay? But from what I read, it was, hey, even by the time of the 300 to 200 BC, they didn't know what these words meant. They knew it was an article of clothing. They didn't know exactly what it was describing, so they went with many colors, okay? Now, as we're going to talk about in this lesson and in future lessons, my next unsolved mystery is about, which I hope to get to in a couple of weeks, is on the Red Sea. Like the Israelites crossing the Red Sea. Well, the Hebrew doesn't say Red Sea. It says the Sea of Reeds every time. And the reason why you have Red Sea is because of a mistranslation back in the 15th century that has been carried on with every English translation since. So that we don't know what body of water they crossed. We don't. Now, there is a modern day body of water called the Red Sea. There's actually fighting happening near the Red Sea right now. You can read about it in the news every day. Maybe the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea, but that's not what it says in the text. It says the Sea of Reeds. Well, there's no modern-day body of water called the Sea of Reeds. So what did they cross? What body of water did they cross? So just to say that as humans, we don't always get the translations right. Okay, I think largely on issues that matter, we do. But we don't always get them right. And so there are many scholars who believe that the translators of the Septuagint just took a guess. Okay? But here's the problem. That guess was picked up by another very, very important translation. And that is the Latin Vulgate. The Vulgate, very soon after the completion of the canon of the New Testament, that's for a topic for another day, but early 4th century that the AD, that the New Testament canon was put together, and shortly thereafter, Jerome, who many will call Saint Jerome, I don't view anybody as, anybody who's a follower of Christ as a saint, but they refer to him as Saint Jerome for other reasons. But Jerome commissioned a translation of, a complete translation of the Bible into Latin, became known as the Vulgate, or the Latin Vulgate, in the 4th century AD, and the Latin Vulgate pulled from the Septuagint using many colors. Okay, so then you fast forward until the 17th century. In the 17th century, we have this little translation called the King James Version, okay? Clearly commissioned by King James of England, okay? And the King James Version also pulled from the Latin Vulgate, pulled from the Septuagint in using the translation many colors. And I don't say this judgmentally. It may have been the same situation. We have no idea what these words mean. It's what it said in the Septuagint. It's what it said in the Latin Vulgate. Let's just go with that. I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know why they chose to translate it that way. Okay, but that was carried forward into the King James, which is why most of popular, both Sunday school culture and greater, pop culture out in the world identifies Joseph's coat as being a coat of many colors is because of the King James Version, right? So we all grew up on. We grew up on the King James. Well, it still leaves us with, we don't really know what those two words mean. We don't really know what they mean, okay? And you can even see this in modern translations, like the English Standard Version. You don't see this in the King James, in the New King James. But in the English Standard Version, which uses many colors, for Genesis 37, there is a footnote. Okay, I had it pulled up in my Bible. Let's see if I still got it up. Nope, I am in Matthew 1:1. That is not going to be helpful. Genesis 37. I'm going to read to you what it says. The footnote beside many colors. It said, "See Septuagint or Vulgate." That's the footnote. Okay. The meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain. Possibly a robe with long sleeves is what it says in the English Standard Version. That is a modern, that was translation completed in 2001, I believe. And so they include a footnote. Now, again, you're not going to find that in the King James. You're not going to find a footnote. You're not going to find a footnote even in the New King James, I don't think. ASV, there's no footnote. I don't know about the New American Standard, if there's a footnote or not. But that's the reason why there is controversy, maybe too strong a word, but disagreement as to what the coat was like, okay? What the nature of it was, okay? Now, what I've given you on the handout, I don't think you'll mind me saying this, but Mike met me this morning and said, it's many colors. It's only that NIV that doesn't say many colors. Well, that's not exactly true. There's a lot of different translations and a lot of different interpretations or renderings in different English translations. At the bottom of page one, I have just given you a survey, okay? I've already mentioned the King James, the New King James, the American Standard Version, and the ESV that translate this as coat, robe, tunic of many colors, okay? But then you've got, like, the New American Standard, they changed it with just a little bit to very colored tunic. Well, that means the same thing, right? Okay, so no change there. But then you've got the NIV. Now, you'll notice that I have NIV 84 and NIV 2010. You're like, I've never seen a Bible called NIV 2010. Exactly, and I'll talk about that in a second. But NIV 84 translated as richly ornamented robe, and 2010, ornate robe. I'm going to stop there for just a second. There is, within Bible translations, there is a lot of, I can't think of any other word than to say politics, and also marketing, okay? The NIV, which came out in 1984, New International Version, which came out in 84, quickly became the most popular translation on the planet. The reason is it's pretty readable, okay? It's pretty readable. And honestly, by a conversation with some folks that I know who are Hebrew scholars, PhDs, pretty good. It's a pretty good translation. But in 2010, they changed the NIV. I mean, did a complete overhaul of the NIV. And they never said a word about it out in the public. And if you went into a bookstore, like the week after the new one came out, it wouldn't look any different on the cover than the old one. Just said New International Version. But if you compared them side by side, you'd go, wow, these are very, very different. They are. They're very different, okay? Why didn't they publicize that it's very different? Because they didn't want people to think it was different. They just wanted to keep buying the NIV. I always make a distinction when I talk about them as to which one I'm talking about, because they're different. And you can even tell in this one thing, there is a difference between richly ornamented robe and ornate robe. They mean the same thing, but they're different words, okay? This is not meant to be a lesson about that, but just there's a lot beneath the surface when it comes to Bible translations that is out there, okay? I included in there the NET Bible, which was a play on acronym. It stands for the New English Translation. They called it the NET Bible because it first was published on the internet before they came out with bound volumes of it. So it was kind of a clever New English Translation, but it's released on the internet. It's the NET Bible. That translation came out of Dallas Theological Seminary. They translated special tunic. The New Living Translation, which I hate that they use the word living in that, because a lot of us know about the Living Bible. The Living Bible was a paraphrase done by one person, okay? By paraphrase, I mean not a translation. It is attempting to take the Hebrew and the Greek and turn it into conversational English without as much concern about accuracy as a true translation would be. A true translation is done by teams of people, not one person. Well, then they decided, Tyndale House decided to come out with a new translation, a true translation done by a large number of scholars, but they chose to use that word living because they were the publishers of the Living Bible and called it the New Living Translation, which I think led a lot of people to think, oh, this is just another paraphrase like the Living Bible. And it's not. It's actually a really good translation. It's a really good translation. But it called it just simply a beautiful robe. And then you have the Revised Standard Version, the New Revised Standard Version that refer to it as a long robe with sleeves. And then the New Century Version in God's Word for Today, special robe. They kind of combine the two. Special robe with long sleeves. Okay. Now, if you flip over your handout, I want to talk a little bit about the politics and translations, okay? And I want to demonstrate this by showing how these same two words are translated differently in the same Bible. They're translated differently in the same Bible, okay? I mentioned my translation that I use primarily is the English Standard Version. When I say primarily, I use lots of translations. Lots. Okay. When I'm preparing for lessons or even doing personal study, I use my computer. You could probably tell that by my iPad. I use my computer, and I'll have five or six of them open at the same time. And the software is such as I'm scrolling through one, the other one's scrolling, I just flip over to it and I can see it. But my primary, and I recommend anybody with Bible study, have a primary translation. Have a primary and then compare it to others. It's always a good thing to compare it to others. But my primary is the English Standard Version, which I have already said in Genesis 37 translates those two words as many, a coat of many colors, a robe or tunic of many colors. Okay. Now, I said a minute ago that those two words, the Kethoneth Passim, are found two other times in Scripture, both of those in 2 Samuel 18, okay? 2 Samuel 18 is, in the verses in question, verses 18 and 19, is talking about a daughter of King David, and that daughter is Tamar. Don't think about the Tamar as in Judah and Tamar back in Genesis, okay? This is Tamar, daughter of David, okay? And if you look in the English Standard Version, it says, now she, which I put the brackets in there, this is in the handout, Tamar was wearing, and what does it say? A long robe with sleeves. So back in Genesis 37, the English Standard Version every time translated as many colors. And 2 Samuel 18, they translate as what? Long robe with sleeves. And it says, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So this identifies that daughters of the king wore this Kethoneth Passim. Whatever it was, that's what they wore. Okay. And then it says, so his servant put her robe out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore thee. Now these are the same words, okay, but this time they just translated it long robe that she wore. And she laid her hand on her head and went away, crying aloud as she went. Now, I put this in there to say this is the same translation, okay, between Genesis 37 and 2 Samuel 18. This is the same team of people that translated both of them. So why in Genesis 37 do they have many colors three times, and why in 2 Samuel 18 do they have long robe with sleeves? I believe it's because the translators thought that the best translation was long robe with sleeves. But they were afraid, if we don't translate it many colors, we're going to get in trouble with everybody. Just like I was afraid I was going to get in trouble with everybody talking about this tonight, right? There's politics in play, okay? You know, we got to appease the masses, so we got to call it many colors. I just think that things like that happen, okay? I told Jeff the other day, I have a professor of mine that was at Lipscomb, who is a PhD in Hebrew. He's contributed to five different Bible translations. And I said, I cannot imagine, talking about the Red Sea, that he would sit in a room translating any of the references to the Red Sea and not translate it as Sea of Reeds, because that's what it says. But is there somebody standing behind him going, got to say Red Sea? You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how that works. I don't know. Was there somebody standing behind the ESV translators going, it has to say many colors? It has to, because all of our Sunday school books have it in there, right? Our flannel graphs, our, you know, all that stuff. Okay, we got to have many colors. I don't know. But it's just interesting to me that even in the same translation, it's translated different ways. In the context, it doesn't really call for it to be translated differently. Okay. So let's talk about possible meanings of those two words. And the reason why I want to go down this route is because this will explain some of the differences, especially in the modern translations. Okay. Because Hebrew scholars are desperately trying to have desperately tried to figure out what these words mean. I mean, even though maybe by the time of the 2nd and 3rd century B.C., they were no longer being used, it was clear at some point they were used, right? I mean, it's five times in our Bibles. So clearly at some point they were being used to describe garments. So what do they mean? Okay, well, here's some different schools of thought, okay? The first one of these I have labeled as Mesopotamian literature, okay? Now, we've been talking about Mesopotamia in our Wednesday night class on Abraham, because Abraham came out of the area, ancient Mesopotamia. But in Mesopotamia, you have a style of writing called cuneiform. You've probably heard of cuneiform writings. Sarah and I were talking about it on the way here tonight, that when she was in one of her classes at school, they were studying about cuneiform, and she had found this song on the internet where it helped you remember things about ancient Mesopotamia, and it mentioned in this song, it mentioned cuneiform. But cuneiform was a language of writing that has been discovered in ancient Mesopotamia. And in all of the cuneiform writings that they have found a reference to a garment. And in those writings, that garment is called, and I've got this there in the handout, I'm going to do my best. I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce this in English, but Kitu Pisenu. I don't know how you're supposed to say it. But they found references to a garment described with those two words. Now, that's cuneiform, not Hebrew, okay? But there are some scholars who think that this is probably roughly analogous to the Hebrew, kinefet pesim, okay? And maybe that these mean the same thing. Now, in the cuneiform writings, this garment is described as a garment that was used to cover female goddess statues. And the distinctive feature of this garment is that it had gold interwoven into the garment with the thread. So in with the material, there was actually pieces of gold in the garment that were sewn into the garment directly. And you can see those translators that follow that school of thought, like the NIV, that translated what? A richly ornamented robe. Where did they get richly ornamented from? From ancient Mesopotamian literature. And saying maybe this is what that Hebrew phrase was meant to represent, saying that this garment was uniquely adorned in some way, maybe with jewels, maybe with gold. Somehow it had some ornamentation on it that a normal robe would not have. And so that comes from ancient Mesopotamian literature. Now, the second one I have listed there is Jewish tradition. According to Jewish tradition, the word that is in there, which is pasim, that the root word pass, Jewish tradition says that pass refers to the palm of the hand. And so, according to Jewish tradition, if you refer to a garment to the hand, what you're referring to is a garment with long sleeves. And clearly, again, if you look at that survey of translations, you see like the Revised Standard, the New Revised Standard, and others that translate it as a robe with long sleeves. Why do they translate it that way? Because they are pulling from the school of thought, which is Jewish tradition, that the pasim is referring to the palm of the hand. And so this is a garment that is made distinct by the fact that it had long sleeves. Okay. And then you have the third thing, which is the idea that this is somehow identified as a royal garment. And this comes from the text itself, not from Genesis 37, 2 Samuel 18. In 2 Samuel 18, who is wearing the kinefet pesim? Tamar, the daughter of David, and identifies that this was the type of garment worn by virgin daughters of the king. Well, if it was only worn by virgin daughters of the king, that would make it a robe associated with royalty. And so therefore, that, you know, what Jacob gave to Joseph was, it was beyond what the common man would wear, but a garment that was reserved for those who are designated as royalty. And so clearly that would be a special coat. And so when you see translations like, again, go back to your survey list, you have some that just talk about it being special or beautiful. That's kind of pulling from that idea. We don't know exactly how it was special, exactly how it was beautiful, but if it was reserved for children of the king, then this was clearly a unique garment. Even if we don't know exactly what it looked like, it was clearly a unique garment that signified royalty. You know, royalty, not the common man, not the one who's going to go out and work the field. This is signifying that this is something that is different. Okay, and that's where I want to end kind of the deep dive on this and transition to what really matters. Is it possible that Joseph's coat had many colors? Sure. Sure. You know, if it was richly ornamented, it could have been many colors. If it was a royal robe, it could have been many colors. It's not to say it didn't have many colors. So I don't want that to, you know, burst your bubble completely, because what I am absolutely convinced of is that it was special in some way, and it was unique. How unique? Well, it was unique enough that it drove his brothers nuts, right? That he had it and the rest of them didn't. It was unique enough that Joseph could be identified just by that garment, right? Because when the brothers, you know, plotted to fake his death and sell him into slavery, what did they bring back to Jacob? Just the coat covered in lamb's blood, right? They just brought the coat back. So this was a, you know, again, we don't know exactly. I'm pretty confident it did not look like the Donny Osmond version, okay? But we don't know exactly what the coat looked like. But it doesn't matter. We know it was unique, and probably unique in a very ornate way, right? I mean, my personal opinion is, especially since the reference to this being a garment of the king's daughters, this was probably not just that it had long sleeves, okay? This was probably a garment that was very distinctive in some way that you might even say, again, was not the kind of garment that somebody would wear out in the field, a garment that somebody would wear around the house, you know? It's like if I were going to lounge around the house and I was wearing something like this, you'd be like, you are nuts, right? You know, this is something that is very, very distinctive. It's very different. And Joseph was distinctive. Now, one way he was distinct is that it tells us flat out Joseph loved him more than all the other sons, right? I mean, that's what comes immediately before he gave him the coat of many colors, or the coat with long sleeves, or the coat with, you know, adornments, right? Whatever it was, it says he was loved more than all the rest. And that, now you think about that distinction and the chain of events that got set off because of it. So because he was most loved by Jacob, and because he was most loved, he was given the coat. And because he was most loved and given the coat, the brothers resented him. Didn't help by the fact that he was interpreting dreams in such a way that didn't speak well of them, right? But they hated him. So that sets that off. He is set apart. He's distinct. He's unique. He's being treated differently than all the rest of us, especially when it's highlighted by this garment that he's wearing. And what did that cause? Well, that caused them to first want to kill him, and then one steps in and saves him, but doesn't save him from a difficult life, saves him from sudden death. But he gets sold into slavery to the point where Jacob doesn't believe he's still alive, because, again, they brought the coat back to him. And then that leads to enslavement, then prison over many years, slave, prisoner, before ultimately rising to the second in command in Egypt, where he did what? He saved what would become the nation of Israel. Jacob's descendants, Israel's descendants. He rose to a position where in God's providence and God's plan, he saved the Jewish race. Now, I've talked about this so much recently, but I want to remind us all that with God's plan, the way he executed the plan was to have a people, okay? And so the people who were in Canaan, Jacob's family, Jacob and his family, the rest of them were in Canaan, but what was coming? A 7-year famine. So in order to preserve them through a 7-year famine, what did he do? By God's providence, he put Joseph in a place where Joseph could prepare. And even though there was a lot of hardship in them being in Egypt, they survived the famine. Because if they had not survived the famine, there would be no people to bring the Messiah into the world. So you think about all of that started. That plan to save his people through 7 years of famine started with Joseph being treated unlike all the other children, all the other sons, exemplified by this coat. So this was, regardless of whether it was strips of technicolor garment, you know, or not, there was something really, really special about this garment. I mean, something really special. And it set off a chain of events that ultimately resulted in the children of Israel being saved from famine. Now, then they endured hardship in Egypt, but then God rescued them again. God rescued them again. But God preserved his people. You know, we're studying about Esther. The story of Esther. God preserved his people. You know, through the Exodus, God preserved his people. And why? Why through all these situations did God preserve his people? Because God's plan was based on having a people to deliver on a promise, right? I mean, that's how he was going to bring about the Messiah into the world. And Joseph was a part of that. And the fact that he was unique set off a chain of events that led to Joseph being the one who planned in such a way to save them from famine. So it doesn't matter what the coat looked like. We can still do Sunday school lessons that have multiple colors. That's fine. Because what we're showing is it was different. It was unique. Okay, there's nothing wrong with it being shown as many colors, or if we want to have pictures of it with ornamentation or long sleeves or whatever. There was something about it that was truly, truly special. Whether it was truly a coat of many colors, whether it looked like Dolly Parton's coat. I've heard several talk about Dolly Parton and her song, Coat of Many Colors. When I was a kid, I saw that garment in the Country Music Hall of Fame. We took a field trip when I was, I mean, probably even elementary school, took a field trip to the old country music back when it was on Music Row. Saw Dolly Parton's Coat of Many Colors in the Hall of Fame. Whether it looked like that or not, it was a special coat. And again, through God's providence, Joseph was instrumental in saving his father's family, giving them a place to live, giving them food to eat, and preserving them so that ultimately the Messiah could come. The Messiah came to save us. We talked about that a lot this morning. The Messiah came to save us. And what we have to do to accept that salvation is we have to respond. We have to choose. We're not adding anything to the equation, but we have to choose to follow him or not follow him. If you're here tonight, you've never made that choice, and you are ready to make that choice, we are always ready to help you to make that choice. If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while Steve leads us in our invitation song.